Hi, if I could take a moment of your time before we start, if you've enjoyed previous episodes or if you enjoy this episode, if you could subscribe on the platform that you listen to, that would be really helpful. It helps us get more guests and push the podcast forward. Thanks.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Car Chat Podcast. This week, I'm with Paul Cockle. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome. I say welcome. Welcome to the podcast, but I'm actually in your space. Can you tell me a little bit about sort of who you are and what you do?
So I'm the owner and the founder of Rennsport. And we basically build lovely 911s, I like to think, here.
Yeah. We've just been out for a drive in one of your cars. I had a drive. It was a lot of fun. We'll get into the cars in a little bit. So this Rennsport, the founder, how did this sort of come about? What were you doing before? How did it come about?
When I left school when I was 16, I went straight into doing an apprenticeship at the Porsche main dealer, which was our local one in Warwick.
All right, yeah.
And then that was the beginning of my love affair with 911s, I think. So it was when the impact bumper cars were new. So it was in the mid to late 1980s.
Nice.
So I know them inside out now.
And did you choose Porsche as a brand to go to want to work for at that point in time, or were they sort of nearby?
I think I did in a way, because there was when I left school, I went on to do three interviews. One was at TWR, which was the Jaguar at the time in Coventry. One was at Monarch Cars, which was the Porsche dealership. And one was at, I think it was like another Jaguar specialist, but Porsche was the one that I wanted to do.
Yeah. So you worked at the dealership for a while. I presume dealerships back then have probably changed quite a bit to the model now, where it's like open a book and just follow the instructions.
Plug the computer in these
Plug
days.
Plug the computer in, yeah.
No, so I'm back in the sort of 80s when these cars were new, it was more, you had to know how to rebuild a car and you had to know how to fix a problem without sort of reading it from a book. So it was like a lot of knowledge. So there was a lot of college and work that we did at college with all the qualifications and stuff. And that's, it's sort of old school mechanics, which is lost now. You know, there's not that many people that do it, you know, especially on modern cars, dealerships. They don't, there's some good guys in dealerships these days, but most of it is the computer says change the engine.
Yeah. It's just not running quite correctly.
Yeah.
Rip it out, put a new one in.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that's the way it is. But in the old days, a car would come in with a misfire and then you'd find out, you know, there's a burnt out valve in it and you'd have to strip it down and change the valve. And that would be sort of part of what you do. You had to know how to do it.
Yeah. And did you get a really good grounding in like the whole car at that point in time, or were you kind of they sort of put you towards a certain element?
I think when I did my apprenticeship, they ran it quite well where we were, and it was a small dealership, but they did sort of run it well. The guys that I was working under, the senior technicians, were very good at doing what they're doing. They're old school Porsche mechanics, and they did sort of let me have a go at doing everything I possibly could, although, you know, being 17 and 18 year old, yeah. You did also have to do the hunting for the water leaks while they squirt it with a hose pipe and all the rest of it. So, but no, there was a big sort of, did a bit of everything, you know. So I'd be there when they were building an engine, taking the gearbox out and rebuilding that, as well as doing electrics and all the stuff that sort of makes you learn how it should all work.
I've always, when I come across it now, because it is so different from taking a modern car to a modern dealership, you take a older car, like my 911 or whatever, in, and you're like, can you diagnose what's going on or just have a look at it? And someone will have a little poke around the car, take the car for like a 5-10 minute little sort of shakedown, come back, and then just write out like a 3 pages of like specific things that need fixing. And I look at it and go, you've worked that all out in like 15 minutes. That is incredibly impressive.
No, we never really used to happen like that. It would come in for a fault, and then you do learn the old school way of diagnosing a fault and knowing what's wrong with it just by listening to it.
Yeah.
Or you do get that old fashioned thing of when the car does come in, the fault's gone away.
Yeah.
That happens quite a lot.
That still happens today.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
So you're working at this dealership. And then where did you go from there?
So I worked at the main dealer, and then I got the guy that I was actually working under, who was the senior technician, went and worked for Eurotech, which was a race team on old 911s at the time. They were based in Warwick. And I basically followed on with him. And then I went to work there for several years.
Doing more of the same.
It was more race cars, so it was It was 2.7 RSs was the main car, when they weren't worth an awful lot of money.
Yeah.
So they were used as race cars, and I really enjoyed it.
And were you, so at that point, were you providing like track support and all that sort of stuff, or were you just working on the cars and then?
We were doing pit crew work and track support and test days, and so I was in the workshop and out. It was good fun.
There any, like, I always hear something happens. Inevitably, I look at the mechanics that are working on a track, whether it's a race event or whatever, and the amount of stuff that seems to have to be done in no time, and just gets the ability to just diagnose a problem, change a gearbox, whatever, in like no time. Presumably that takes a bit longer on a 911, but were there lots and lots of that sort of action?
There wasn't massive amounts of it. I suppose the worst thing would be, because we were looking after customers' cars, it would be they would crash in qualifying and you'd have to tape the car back up together so they could actually do the race, which is what they were there for. You know, that would happen quite often, but that's about it, really.
Yeah, that's it. Getting stuff back into shape and just out the door on the way. So you then worked there. And then what point in time did you start the concept for Rennsport and...
It was sort of later on in life, really. So Eurotech moved into Birmingham, and I followed them into Birmingham for a while, but then that was just too far to travel. And and then you change as you get a little bit older. And then Rennsport sort of was conceived really from my love affair of having a 911 myself, which I bought one back in to sort of get back into 911s, because I went off the rails onto Escort Cosworths and things like that.
There's one sitting over there.
Yeah.
Is that reliving the dream?
Something like that, yeah. Reliving the nightmare, I think, is a bit more like it.
Has it been a pain?
Everything breaks, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's eventful. Not as eventful as a DeLorean, but it's eventful. So Rennsport sort of evolved just after early 2010, 2011, which was building my own car.
Yeah.
And then I sold it and then did another one and sold it. And then eventually we've ended up here.
Well, yeah. And this is a pretty, I'm going to say, a pretty sweet looking place. How many iterations were there before you got to here? Because this is a big setup.
Well, I went through life in my sort of 30s and 40s and made money out of property.
Okay.
You don't make money out of this game. So I made my money out of property. And then with the help of my dad, who's a designer and a property developer, we bought this plot of land and then built the building around 911s.
Nice.
So you're not going to get a Range Rover on the ramp, but you can get two 911s in there easy enough.
And how did you set out? So at the time you'd picked G series cars or something that you liked, what were you working on it then?
We've done G series are probably the easiest ones to use, and we've sort of, it's evolved into our sort of basic, term of what we do now, which is producing a pre-73 car, because that's what everybody wants. They want the old style with that. They don't want the impact bumpers. There's a few people out there that like impact bumpers, but it's not us.
Seems to be growing.
It is, because people want that classic old 911, but they don't want the classic old problems of the tin one that comes with them, because they all seem to go rotten, the old ones. And they want some power, and they want brakes, and they want air conditioning, and they want electronic suspension, and they want all the goodies with it, but they want the class. That's what they want, yeah.
Well, they're cool, aren't they? They're just really cool.
Yeah, well, the beauty of this is this is the one job that I can actually get to do what I want to do, and I enjoy doing it, which is important.
Do you find you have to spend an annoying amount of time doing stuff that you don't? Like, is there one part of the whole process that you're like, I just wish there was some way I could spend no time doing that? Talking to people on a podcast.
Yeah. I was trying not to say that then. I do enjoy every part of it, you know, from meeting the customers for the first time to going through all the specs that they want to do and tailor making a car to fit them, which is what we've become good at. You know, we'll sit down with the customer before they might have in their mind what they want to build, and I'll sit down with them and I'll go through, you know, it's like sitting down on a podcast, but you're not recording it. So we'll go through what they want to use the car for and, you know, what's their ultimate thing that they want at the end of it. Yeah, and then we sort of build the car around that. So every car is different. We don't produce a car and then say, right, what colour seats do you want? Yeah. What colour do you want on the outside? We start off with what you want to use it for, whether it be track use or a nice daily driver or European touring or a mixture of everything, you know, and we sort of combine it because we want to build a car that people really want. And, you know, that's what makes it fun, because you have somebody with a big smile on the face at the end of it, and they come back each year for a service and they're using it, not just sort of, oh, I don't use it because it's too bouncy or, you know, that's where it all comes into.
And because you see some people nowadays making like a product. They're like, they've picked it and gone, we make the whatever they've called it, and then you can change your seat color or tweak a little thing or whatever. And have you specifically chosen to not go down that route, or you like that? You just like the whole bespoke factor.
It does very often. It can quite often go down that route because people will come in and see a car that's already been built and then say, "I like that color and I like that style and I like those seats." And you end up with, you know, we went through a spate of building 10 cars all exactly the same. But no, we will build. It's tailor made. Which is where our sort of niche market is.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a product that we make. We make the product for the customer, you know, and every car is different. And that's where we are.
It's really interesting looking, because we're sitting, if you're watching the video, you'll be able to see a little bit in the background, possibly some cars. And when I can look down, and actually there seems to be a slight theme at the moment. If I look, poke around a little bit, there's a little bit of green and there's a lot of orange actually. Is that what's happened? Has someone come in and gone, oh, I quite like that green car. Can you make me a green car?
That's exactly what happens. So we I think it was probably about 8 years ago, we built a slate grey 911, which was a replica of the Steve McQueen car from the film Le Mans.
Yeah.
And then 10 slate grey cars later, somebody actually chose an orange one. So quite often, you know, people do choose the colours from cars that are in here. And it does tend to sort of roll like that. You know, we will go through a state. If you came 3 months ago, there was 5 Gulf Blue cars down there.
Right, yeah.
You know, so it's
funny because I find the concept, when someone says, like you're saying, you can have anything. You know, you can have whatever colour you like. Well, that's a really difficult decision. That's really hard. Like my SC is signal yellow. And I wouldn't, before I saw the car in person, I wouldn't have wanted a signal yellow car. I was kind of like, I wasn't really into yellow. And then I saw the car and I was like, oh no, that looks awesome. So there is an element of, you don't necessarily know until you've seen possibly something similar. Maybe Instagram's probably really helpful these days of like giving you an idea. Have you had any unusual things that people have said, I want the color, you to do the color of this object, this building, a house or like that?
There's always one, isn't there? we did a car 10 years ago now for a guy from Holland. There's a really nice guy called Rob. And we had to match the color. It was purple, but we had to match it to his late wife's wedding dress. And that,
right.
And that was probably the most unusual thing I've ever been asked for on a colour, you know. And we did the colour match, and it was a bit strange, but it looked fabulous when the car was done.
Yeah.
You know, it's a one-off colour. It was quite a bright purple, but it did look really cool.
And then, if someone's done that and it's significant to them, when the next person comes in and goes, "I mean, that colour looks really good. Can we have that colour?" Do you go, "It'd be good if you didn't."
well, we've probably done a one-off colour 3 or 4 times, yeah.
Yeah, because I guess nowadays, with everyone sharing everything on the internet, I don't know, I think I see a nice colour and I'm like, it's nice, whatever. If there's 3 of them, I don't care. It's my car, I'm enjoying it. I'm not so bothered about it being unique as such. But do you get little things, you must do, little things done to all the cars just for that owner that's like, I want a secret storage compartment or things like that?
I think everything on them is the little thing, you know, because every car is, you know, they'll all have slightly different dashes, or they'll all have slightly different stereos, or they'll all have slightly different engine configuration. So, you know, there are lots of little things that are unique to each car. Mm. You know, they're never exactly the same.
Yeah. Well, it's different.
Yep. But there's no hidden storage compartments anywhere.
So talk me through it. So if I came to you now and I come here and I say, I want a car, because I believe you had a customer this morning that wanted a car, but they weren't sure what they wanted. How does that conversation go?
Well, we're basically, they're obviously here because they want a 911. So we know it's going to be a 911 to start with. Yeah. Not an Escort. not getting into those. So we know they want a 911 to start with. We then sort of sit down. If they haven't got a complete idea in what they want, you know, and they've seen a picture of a car and say, I want one like this, that's when we sit down and say, right, what are you going to use it for? You know, are you going to use it to go to the pub on a Sunday and nothing else? Are you going to go and tour around Italy in it? Are you going to go and do track days in it? What do you want it for? So that's when we sit down, and that's when we also have to delve into, what cars have you had before as well? Because that's quite an important one. You know, if you're speaking to somebody who's only had new cars and they've never driven a classic car, then maybe a G-Series old 911 is not the one to stick them in. Maybe we need to stick them in a 964 that's got power steering and all the wet stuff that later cars have. ABS.
Let's run this process slightly, because I'm always interested in, like, you know, what 911 would I choose? And in my head, I have an idea. But like, if I was coming to you, let's say I'm coming to you and I'm saying I want a car. Let's run the Let's run through a few.
So what are you watching? Okay, so you've got an unlimited budget.
Let's just say it's unlimited.
That's good to know.
Why not? So you've got an unlimited time as well. Yeah.
So I'm going to see you a lot then, am I?
No, as in you can have the car for it. Actually, how long does it take generally to do a build?
12 months. 12 months start to finish. And that is from, depending on what time of year, but that's from the build slot that we allocate. So the guy that's been in this morning, his build slot's allocated August. So he'll be looking at a completion date August next year.
Yeah.
It's never sooner and sometimes a little bit later, but not really. You know, we run a sort of production line on what we do on the basic stuff. So, everything's all done in-house. So we're in control of it all.
Nice.
Which makes the big thing. We're not screaming and waiting for somebody to provide a gearbox or something like that. We know we've got to build it. We know which one's going to get done.
Yeah, because we talked a little bit about that when we were driving earlier, about how some cars, we were talking about, you look at various cars in this space and the price is just going like up and up and up and up and up. And you look at it and go, like, I don't know how you get here. But you were saying that's one of the brilliant things about doing, like, you do your own engines and stuff. You're not sending an engine to someone else who's then got to make a profit just on the engine. And then it's coming back to you and you've got to make a bit of profit. So then you're just whacking a chunk on every element of the car that goes out. You've got to put a chunk on it.
Well, yeah, you soon get sort of carried away and, you know, the price ends up being 400,000 or 500,000 when the car should only be 200,000 or 300,000 because you send the engine away and the guy that's building the engine's making 25,000 out of it. And then you've got somebody else that's building the gearbox that's making 6,000 or 7,000 out of it. Or someone that's making a sub-assembly suspension kit for it, which is making 10,000 or 15,000 out of it. It's all done here. The benefit of that is also, we can keep a 100% eye on quality and control, and we can fix it when it goes wrong because we know exactly how it all works because we built it. You know, we know it's going to be reliable. We know that's the way it is.
I presume your sort of like processes and even the technologies used in the cars has changed massively since you started to now. What have been some of the sort of big developments or changes in the way they've all been done?
Well, we've got rid of the adjustable spanner and bought proper spanners. I think probably the main technology difference that we've got now is the injection systems on the engines.
Right.
Yeah. You know, we actually have to plug them into a laptop and work out all the parameters and get them set up that way. Whereas the old school 911s, you didn't have to plug in the ECU and away you went. But, you know, now we have to sort of change settings on things electrically. But everything else is still fairly basic, to be fair. You know, it's all pretty simple stuff. Yes, everything's all better quality and higher performance, but it's still the same basis at the end of the day. So, you know, the guys that I've got here, they're all superb and they know exactly what they're doing and they know how to put things together and fix them and make sure it's right.
Yeah. Not leave a spanner in somewhere running around.
No. Hopefully not.
So let's continue with this. If I want a car. I think I want a narrow body car. I like the idea of less grip, whatever that means. Do I in reality? I don't know, but I think so. And more fun at lower speed. Like I don't need it. It's not going to be a track car. And if it is a track car, it's going to be going around a corner like slightly sideways at a lower speed. That's fine. No idea what engine, no idea what gearbox. Where do we go from there?
I can find another customer. So we would, I mean, visually you'd probably, in my head, I would sort of show you a couple of pictures of an early narrow-bodied 911 and, you know, would sort of come to the conclusion that you're after something that looks like a late 1960s, early 1970 narrow-bodied 911 with 15-inch skinny wheels on it, because that sounds like what you're after, classic-looking thing. That fixes the problem of the less grip.
Yeah.
And then it would all be down to, obviously, you've got an unlimited budget, so we'll just put as most powerful engine in it that we could. You wouldn't sell you a a 4 litre 964 engine conversion, because you're not going to need it because you've only got 6 inch
tires
on the back of it. So, you know, we would probably say, right, well, let's work on the basis of a 3 litre SC or a 3.2 Carrera conversion and build it up from that.
And what can you do in terms of engine? So the car, what can you go from to in terms of engine specs and I guess characters as well?
It's sort of unlimited what we can do on an engine. So the donor car tends to be a big sort of majority of where we're going to start with. So if we start with a 3.2 Carrera, which we do a lot of, because they're just a very well evolved 911, we will start with a 3.2 engine, you know, so we've got the crankcases.
Yeah.
And then just depending on the budget and the spec and what it's going to be used for, if somebody's got a limited budget, you haven't, so I'm not going to sell you the standard injection system and keep it at 3.2. So we know that we don't need to go over the top with the power, you know, so we would probably suggest a 3.4 conversion, which is still fairly economical in price wise. You know, it's not a ridiculous amount of money to go into it. There's no unnecessary extra machining work that needs doing. It's a lot of bolt-on parts when you strip the engine down. And then if you want fun, we would go on throttle bodies, because then you've got the noise of the induction and so on. And then you've got the programmable side of it, so you can set it up right. And we can set it up so that it works well for what the car is. You know, we can set the right torque curve on it and the right power figure.
Yeah.
It's not always worth going for the maximum power figure on an engine. You know, we'll often wind, it sounds a bit crazy, but you can wind 25 horsepower off it and it's a faster road car.
Yeah, you've got, I guess you get much more possibly torque, mid-range punch.
Yeah.
Like that car, the blue car, I'm just going to keep calling it the blue car. What do you call that?
That's our RS, well, as a car.
Yeah.
That's our RS 2.7 anniversary car. So it's the 50 years of the 2.7 this year, 73.
And that's got a 3.4?
It's just over 3.4. And that is running 325 horsepower.
Yeah.
We could run more, but it makes it completely undrivable. And it's just that top trumps sort of thing. You know, I've got 328 horsepower. It's not all about that.
Well, that in itself is an interesting one where you see, like, you know, I come here and you can say you could have a 3.2 or 3 litre, whatever it works out, all the way up to 4 litres. And you see with a lot of people coming in and specing the cars, I imagine as the money gets up, goes up and up and up, people are more likely to just tick the box because they're like, well, why would I not have the 4 litre engine? Like, why would I not? So I might just have that. Whereas actually, as you said, it's much more nuanced than that, isn't it? It's like, if you're going to genuinely use the car, you don't want something, well, it depends on what you're going to use it for. But normal-ish touring, whatever, you don't want something that's on the ragged edge and like snarly. You probably don't. You might do.
I would. No, you don't. We won't sell people things that they don't need. You can quite easily say, yes, you need a 4 litre engine. It's going to cost you £100,000 for the engine. When a 3.4 litre engine based on a 3.2 crankcases will suffice good enough for the weight and the style of the car. And you basically couldn't drive it any quicker than what we're going to put in it.
Yeah.
You know, you were just, I'm not in the game for just spending people's money for the sake of it, thinking, I've managed to get a £500,000 car out of them. And it's just, that's not what we're in it for. We're in it just to sort of, you know, you still need a good spec for your quality, you know. That's what you need.
Yeah, and the cars are light.
Yeah,
reasonably light anyway.
The G series cars that we run plenty of soundproofing on them because we build them as road cars. They're sort of 1,050 kilos, 1,100 on some of the ones that we go right over the top on. Yeah,
and that with 300 and a bit horsepower, like driving this car earlier, that's plenty fast enough. It's properly fast.
Well, you work out the power to weight ratio, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you compare it to modern, like a modern car that might be 14, 50 kilos. And there's definitely, I'm sure there is a tipping point, but like brake horsepower per ton as a figure doesn't tell you anything without the weight of the car. Because like my estate, it's probably got a pretty punchy brake horsepower per ton figure. It's probably actually quite similar, maybe less than that blue car. But to drive, one weighs 1,800 kilos and feels like a boat. Whereas if one weighs 1,000 kilos or 1,100 kilos, you get that kind of, you're driving something light and you get a good experience.
It is all about the enjoyment of it, isn't it? And you do, you know, I had an R35 Nissan, you know, the GTR with 820 horsepower.
Nice.
And I don't know what they weigh at, like 17 or there, a heavy old beast. And it was phenomenally quick. But I get more fun driving my old 911 out of it. And the old 911 feels quicker. And it actually feels safer because you know you're not doing 190 mile an hour. And you know.
Yeah, you get that. I find if you're driving something that's like big and heavy but fast, you almost get a disconnect because you look at the speed and you know you're going fast. It doesn't really feel that fast. And you also know that you can't really stop that quickly. And like it's a sort of disconnect almost of like where reality is. Have you been through a sort of with your own like personal cars and what you enjoy driving, have you been through like a cycle of going, I want something really fast, and then like actually I want something older, and then have you been through a bit of a journey like that?
I still go through that journey all the time. So I think, so if you work out last year, I went from a GTR with 800 odd horsepower to a Defender double cab.
Nice.
And then I went from, and then I had a DeLorean amongst it all as well.
Oh, wow.
They're pretty underpowered for what they are, to be fair.
I don't hear good things about them.
It was cool. It's the coolest car in the world. You know, you go everywhere, everybody's like, that is a cool car. That is so cool. You know, you go to Costa and you open up the Gullwing doors. And I feel the coolest person. But when you actually put your foot down, it's the crappiest car in the world. It's like, this ain't going to do 88 mile an hour. That's for sure. But no, so I do go through those cycles. You know, I've had a 911 turbo and then sort of, but the most fun cars are the ones that we do. You know, I'm a big fan of our own product.
Yeah, that's good.
That's what it's at. The only problem that I have is I normally build a car for myself. Someone comes along and buys it and then I've got to... I've got to try and talk everybody into doing overtime to sort of squeeze it in between all the customers' car, and it's a year later, and then it all happens again.
You've got to do it in a colour that, although it's not very good business sense, but do it in a colour that no one wants. But then people will want that colour and you're stuffed. If you were building a car for you, starting fresh, what route would you go?
Well, that's a fairly easy thing to say because I've just about finished building the car, the next demonstrator car, which is an ST with the same spec engine in as my blue RS car.
Right.
So it's a 3.4 high compression engine on throttle bodies. It's like very exquisite trim in it. Mm. Everything's over the top. We've got a good stereo system in it, which we haven't really done before. You know, we've got a subwoofer under the seat and stuff like that.
I'm all for it. A sound system in a car.
You know, we're basically doing that. So it's in Irish green. It's got saddle brown leather. You know, it's a great car. And then
is that in here somewhere?
It's just outside waiting to go on the ramp to have its engine fitted. But that is one of those things that unfortunately someone's bought it before I finished it. So
I thought it looked a bit high. I was like, are you doing a Dakar version?
Yeah. No, just ready to fit the engine in it. Yeah. So I've now got a sort of my biggest dilemma when I'm building a car is, what colour am I going to do next?
Yeah.
Because I know what my favourite car is. It's the ST that we do, which was the same as the car 100, which we did, which went to Japan. That is my favourite style of car because they're just right. They're very popular build, but it's what colour is next.
Do you, because I have like a favourite colour, but as time goes on and I start to have owned probably too many cars in that color, I realize that I need to own other colors. And then like, you're like, oh, what's the next? You can't just keep, like for me, like a mid blue Porsche Aqua Blue is the color I like, with like a tan. If that was like, if I could spec that, I'd have that all day long. But now I look around and I've got, there is part of me that needs to have a green car at some point. But I almost think green is like, I'm too late for the green. I've got to go past it.
Greens this year, that's definite. I went through the same, like when I was younger, everything was orange.
Yeah.
I had an orange Lotus Sunbeam. I had an orange Fiesta. I had an orange RS Turbo. I had an orange Escort Cosworth. Everything was orange, but I think you do get a bit sort of tired of it. And I often start, I have had a couple of orange 911s and they do look cool, but I think you can overdo it a little bit. And then...
And it's nice to have something different every now and then. Yeah. And actually... Well, then, because you're building the car that you're like, I really want that car, and then you sell it to someone because it's great, you get to explore the different options.
Yeah, you do. My cars normally sell because I put everything on it that's needed or not needed.
Yeah.
And generally, the people that buy them know that that's what they're getting, and they will sort of offer me more money than what a new build is because they know it's
ready to go.
It's got lots of development stuff in it, which is, you know, because we are always developing stuff on the injection systems and on suspension. We're always tweaking it and making things a little bit better. And, you know, they know that mine's going to have all the latest and best stuff
on
it.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk through some of the stuff that goes into the car. Suspension. What are the sort of suspension options and commonly fit things?
So, I mean, generally, if we starting off as a base car, running on a G-Series 911 as a donor car. So the basic option, if we're starting at the bottom of the budget, if someone's got 150 grand, say, it's like, right, it's going to be basic stuff.
Is that plus the donor?
Including the donor, generally, yeah. So we would run Bilstein Sport dampers, which is pretty much what they used to run on the 3.2 Carreras.
But that's the sort of thing I've got, I think.
Yeah, and it works well. But sort of over the last few years, we've sort of developed and gone more into the tractive, semi-active suspension system, which is a bit of technical wizardry, really. And it's sort of, you know, it's a complete modernization on the way the cars drive and run. So I would say probably 90% of the cars that we build now, people will have that.
Yeah.
You know, because they've got the adjustability of having an all-rounder from sort of driving around on a Sunday afternoon to the pub and so on, to going doing a track day, to doing touring. It's just on the set of a button, and that's the way it goes.
Do you find yourself playing with that endlessly?
I did when we first fitted the first one. It was continually. But now, no. I know what it's set on. I know what to put the settings to, and I memorise it on number two, and then that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Country road, city, probably don't even have that. And then like track. Job done.
Generally, I'll only adjust it if I'm showing somebody what it can do.
Okay. Yeah.
So I'll have number. There's five presets that you can already preset. Although we run the screen, so you can make it fully adjustable. But I'll set number one on full soft of everything, and number five on full hard of everything.
Yeah.
And that shows you the massive parameter. And then I'll just have one setting. The novelty's worn off a little bit for me.
But
it works.
Does it, because I know it has tons of sensors, like G, force, speed, all that sort of stuff. Does it know how fast you're going?
No, it generally just runs on a G sensor. So it just runs on the G force sensor, which is in the middle of the car. And then that works it all out for itself. It works it out for itself what to do.
So can you have softer settings at lower speeds and stiffer at higher speeds within one button?
Yes. So what, if you've got it on one setting?
It's on one setting that you've not changed. Can it run softer at, like, let's say sub 20 miles an hour?
Not really, no.
Not sure. Okay.
No.
Yeah.
To a certain extent.
I think that is...
But not a massive... No, that would be like...
I think that's quite complicated.
That would be like fully active.
Yeah.
Whereas this is more semi-active.
Yeah.
You know, it still needs a bit of input from you.
Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Yeah, the button on the cars I've driven, and we didn't play with the one today, I've always been super impressed with the difference. The difference between like full stiff and full soft. Happy days. Like you're not having to get spanners out or reach behind wheel arches to do some clicks on the track to change your settings and whatnot. What do you get? I was about to say parts. Is it easier to get parts now than it used to be?
No, it's got harder since we left Euro.
Oh, right, yeah.
That's made everything an absolute pain in the butt, that has. We can still get every part. Things have got a lot more expensive. And there's not so many people, suppliers that we use, don't stock as much stuff as they used to. They will get it into order rather than stocking a lot of stuff. But no, we can still get every single part for a 911 that we need. But generally fairly quickly.
Yeah, because I hear of things, you know, stuff has got more expensive. But like, can you give me an example or a rough guide of like how things might have changed over the last, I don't know, 5 years in terms of getting stuff and ignoring timings? Have things got more expensive?
Everything's got more expensive in in general in the world, in life, hasn't it? But no, parts, I think the biggest cost difference is because we now have to pay import duty on everything. And we also have to pay sort of shipping on stuff because, you know, there's not container loads of stuff coming over in one go and being stocked here, and it can be shipped backwards and forwards as it's needed. It's, you know, so you have to pay an awful lot. It's basically... Some components we buy from America, and we've always bought from America, which that's always been the same. Yes, you have to pay your import duty and you know where you are with it.
Yeah.
Now you've got that additional cost with everything that comes from Europe, you know, and obviously being German cars, a lot of stuff does come from Europe.
Yeah. And has that made it trickier as well working? Because presumably do you have quite a lot of international customers?
We do. So the international side of it is, that's a different ball game completely because it's sort of exclusive of VAT and so on. So if it's getting shipped straight back out again, then, you know, there's different rules and regulations on the VAT and the import stuff. So
okay, so can someone own a car in another country, wherever, somewhere, and then it comes in under some sort of special rule, gets worked on, goes back out, doesn't necessarily get taxed and stuff as it comes through?
No, so you don't have to charge them. You don't have to charge them VAT because the stuff's getting exported straight back out.
Okay.
Which they obviously have to pay their import duty when it goes back into the country, but you know that's their side of the problem, not mine.
Their problem. Yeah. And what does if I said, right, we're saying the base. If you went sort of lower end of specs, a car might be 150k, depending on what day and what car and whatever. What's the sort of, if you came in and ticked most of the boxes, what does that come out at?
So with a G series car, with the ones that we do with, to a really good level and a high spec is 300,000, maybe a little bit more. You know, we do look at other people that are building similar cars, and they are you know, they are more money, and I think that's just more profit for the people that are doing it. We, you know, we still work on a good volume of cars, and you know, that's why we're sort of successful in what we're doing, because we're providing a good value for money, which is partly why people come to us as well, because they know that they're going to be paying over the top for, you know, I would say somebody's flash showroom, but we've got a flash showroom, but you know, we own the building, so it's a different matter, isn't it? But no, sort of three, if somebody came and said, I want to spend 500,000, I'd have to try
think
and
of some, think of some ways of doing it.
Start looking for some good holidays for myself or something like that. Yeah.
I don't even know what I'm going to do with that. Oh, okay. Hang on a minute. And so you do a lot of G Series cars. You do some 964s. Do you prefer, what sort of, would you say the difference on the final product or even the starting product, but like between a 964 build and a G Series?
They're a completely different car. So when you actually come to drive it, although you can make them look exactly the same, you know, you can have them parked side by side and you can make them look identical on the outside. You know, there's always the tunnel giveaway in the middle where the sort of prop shaft goes on a 964. But they are a completely different car. You know, the panels on the outside are the same, but underneath is nothing like each other. So the cars drive completely different. A 964 is a lot heavier. It's a lot more like a modern car, but you feel like you're driving a heavier car. And it's sort of an evolution that just everything put on weight with cars, didn't it? Yeah. Safety features.
Because they're what, like 200 kilos heavier or something to start with?
Yeah, more than that, I think. It's a ridiculous amount.
So then, I've noticed, like, if you drive any of the 964 builds I've built, even if they've had lots of carbon fiber on them, still feel very similar to the G Series or SC builds in terms of like weight, because they must be pretty similar, or the G Series are probably lighter. But then you're starting from a different point. You've got a bit more tech.
Well, the G Series cars are lighter, and they do end up being lighter even at the final product, because the actual main chassis and the sort of carcass and the body shell underneath's different. You know, it's a lot heavier on a 964. But you find that sort of, you know, we run 325 horsepower on a good spec engine in a G Series car in one of our STs. You've got to run sort of 450 horsepower out of a 964 to be the equivalent,
right?
To get that feel good factor out of it.
And that's a much more expensive engine to build, presumably. Or is it not too bad? It's to get 450.
To get up to 450, you've got to start throwing a load more money into it. Yeah.
So do a lot of people go for cages?
Not, they used to. So sort of 6, 7, 8, 9 years ago, we were doing a lot of 2.7 RS replicas, and people would want just the front seats, rear seat delete, and the roll cage in the back. So we used to do that on nearly all of them, and a lightweight carpet. But now, no. People want it to be more like a road car.
Because I sort of like the idea of a cage. From a safety point of view, like if you have an accident, it's less sketchy. I'm going to say less sketchy because you don't want to have an accident in any of those cars.
You do know there's a petrol tank in the front, don't you?
Yeah, there's all sorts of great stuff.
Yeah.
that you need to move your legs out of the way of and face and everything. I like the idea of a cage, but I kind of like almost hidden.
It does make you feel safer. So my RS that we've built, this anniversary one, we've got a full FIA cage in that, which we've had trimmed in Murrhead leather. And it's, you know, the scrim foam underneath it. So it is quite padded and it's all done color-coded to the trim inside. So it doesn't stand out like, wow, there's a roll cage in there, bright, shiny red one on a white car sort of thing. It sort of disappears into it. It does make you feel safer when you're driving it. You've just been out in it yourself, haven't you? You know, you're strapped in and you feel like you're in a solid, safe car.
Yeah, and if you're going on track, you can put the door bars in.
Yeah.
And you've got a bit more. Just don't hit anything. That's the... Yeah. But yeah, they're not. They're all good. Good fun. What do you think... I was going to say how much is picked by... What do you think makes a successful Porsche resto mod?
a happy customer at the end of it. Yeah. That's a successful one.
Yeah.
You can do a resto mod any way you want that you think you should be doing it. But the most important thing is that the customer has got the smile on their face when they come and pick it up. And then a year later, they come back to you and say, this has changed my life. You know, and we've had customers like that. And it does make it, you know, it makes the lads feel good downstairs. They come back and they've still got that 18-year-old silly grin on their face that they've just learned how to do a donut sort of thing in a car.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
You know, and they're sort of 60 years old. But they come back with that sort of big grin on their face even a year later and they say, I love it. I love every bit of the car. You know, that's what makes it a successful one.
That's awesome. Have you had any customers taking their cars to like pretty extreme places or done some pretty insane road trips and things like that?
We've got husband and wife team, which have got, they've got two cars. They've got a Targa and a coupe.
Nice.
They use the Targa for a lot of continental trips. So they do these European driving days where there's sort of six or seven people in different cars. You know, there'd be an E-Type and an Austin Healey. 911 always makes it to the end.
I think they all break down.
The other ones all break down on the way. I don't think they've done much in the last couple of years since COVID, but that, you know, that was a big thing and they really enjoyed that. They love that car. But no, there's a lot of people that just use them for sunny days and fast driving around in the Yorkshire Dales, you know, things like that. But no, they do. So we had a customer send a picture of his car at the back of his multi-million pound super yacht in Monaco once.
Nice.
Was fair play to you, you know, because he drove there in it.
Nice.
You know, so they do get around. You know, we've obviously got car 100, which we did, and we also did a Targa, which were the first two cars which have gone out to Tokyo. You know, and we've got, they send us pictures of those because they've sold to the customers out there now, and you know, driving around in what looks like Tokyo Drift.
That's cool.
Yeah, you know, it is good.
Yeah, that's got to be the best part. I keep trying to remind myself that like I like cars, but I love doing stuff with cars. And if you're not doing stuff with cars, that's what happens. Is if your car sits around for ages and you're not using it, I'm like, I don't care about it anymore. Almost like, but then if I could pop back into or just immediately transport myself somewhere else with the car, I'm having the best time ever. It's almost like not necessarily the car. It's like where you are and what you're doing.
That's what they do in Dubai, isn't it? They fly the car by helicopter to
to somewhere else.
You don't have to drive it in the horrible bit. They just fly it and land it somewhere to go and pick up.
I'd enjoy that. If I could go anywhere now, some of the most fun I've had, and apologies if you've heard this chat before on the podcast, but is winter Sweden. I took my old 911 with a bunch of mates and different silly cars. And that's just the most fun.
Yeah, I remember selling a car when I was younger and we sold it to a guy in Marbella. And he paid me to drive the car over there,
nice.
You know, through the Pyrenees, and then he paid for the flight back. And that was a fabulous drive, you know. So, I would like to do that in one of our 911s now, rather than, I can't remember what it was, an old S-type Jaguar, one of those horrible things. Yeah.
What do you think, sort of off into the future, do you see maybe working on newer Porsches, or how do you see it? Do you see it sort of changing as time goes on, or almost just like solidifying on where we're at?
I think we're constantly evolving everything that we do with the cars, and they do change with fashion, you know. So, you know, like I said, we did do a lot of 27 RS replicas, and at the moment we're doing lots of STs.
Yeah, so a lot less wings nowadays.
Yeah, so you don't have ducktails on them anymore. Yeah. It's all flat boots, and you don't have the chin spoilers on the front. It's all rounded front bumpers. So it is sort of quite fashion orientated, but it's, I think I see us as just evolving better technology, you know? I would like to say that we can't sort of get any better on the build quality, but every car seems to be better and better and better every time we do it.
That's good. And that's, and it, it must be one of those things where you look at a car, let's say you built a car 5 years ago and you look at it and you're like, that's great. And then you look at it now and you go, well, we've got quite a lot better. Or we've got better at various things.
Well, yeah, we do. But you also look at the fact and think, so you look at a car we did 6 or 7 years ago, maybe side by side with one that's going out today. And the one that goes out today, you know, is a lot better in quality and technology and stuff that goes into it. But you also look and think, it's actually taken us twice as many hours to build that car, and yeah, it's cost twice as much to do it. So it should be better, really.
Yeah.
You know,
the
one 6 or 7 years ago might have been 60 grand, you know, and now they're sort of 300 grand. But it's, yeah, it's taken, there's an awful lot more blood, sweat, and tears that have gone in.
Do you see many coming back through you guys for sale?
Most of them do come back through us. Occasionally they'll get sold out by other dealers. We always get the phone calls to say, I'm looking at a car at this dealer here. You know, can you tell us a bit about it? And we'll end up selling them a new build. As you do. But we've got a good record. We started sort of the last 10 years, which we've been sort of doing the cars in this building here. There's not a car that's resold for less money than the build cost. So every car's made money that we've sold.
That's great,
and that's a good selling point.
Yeah,
you know, we've, the worst that's happened is somebody's got their money back if they've sold it through somebody else. But we always make a profit on the cars for people, so people, they tend to come back to us. And I always do say, if you ever want to sell it, I'll sell it for you.
Yeah,
they're never here for long.
That takes a lot of friction out of the buying process, because that's definitely a worry for me. If I'm getting a bespoke product, is like, does anyone want this after, if I had sell it at some point? And it sounds like absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it is a good track record, 10 years worth of that, you know, because people do worry and think, oh, you know, with a modern car, you can go and buy a new 911 and you lose 30 grand out of it in the first year or so. So people do worry about losing money. And to a lot of people, this is an unknown, you know, but we've got that track record to say, look, every single car that we've built that's been resold has sold for a minimum of the build price. You know, so people, they feel a sense of security straight away.
Yeah.
And we've also got that sort of, you know, we've built 12 years ago. If you want to have a look at those cars, you can see that they're in good quality.
Yeah.
You know, they haven't fallen apart and the customers have still got them.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I guess, as we were talking about before, like, we all change. So the car that was perfect for you 10 years ago, let's just assume you've not got 100 cars. You might be in a different headspace, a different life space, you might want a wing or not a wing. Do you get cars coming back to be sort of tweaked and adjusted and have bits done and things like that?
We do. Some of the customers that have still got their cars from sort of 6 or 7 years ago, you know, so we've had them back where we've fitted tractive suspension on them because we've upgraded from that. We've fitted big brakes on, or we've redone the engine out to 3.4, because, you know, we used to stick, in the early days, we would just stick to a sort of stock 3.2 engine on the original injection system and get the most out of it with an exhaust or something. But no, people do upgrade them. I think it's because they can also see the value in what they're upgrading. You know, they initially had a car which might have cost them 60 grand or 70 grand, and they can see a new one's at that sort of spec with some good stuff on it is selling at 200,000.
Yeah.
They don't mind spending 20 or 30 on it because they know they're not going backwards with it.
Yeah, that's one of the things. I would love some sort of electronic management system in my car to just every time. That's like, it doesn't really matter, but it would be nice. But then this is where it's an endless pit Because especially if I come around and meet like yourself and other people, I'm like, oh, interesting. Let's see what extra stuff you've got going on there. Right. So I normally sort of start tying these up with five questions. Do you have a most memorable driving trip or journey?
Most memorable driving trip or journey would be when I was, I think I was about 19 years old, and we were doing the 24-hour wheel hire race at Snetterton with Eurotech in the when Mike Jordan was running the BMW M3 E30 car. And my most memorable trip was being awake for the qualifying, being awake for the whole of the 24 hours. absolutely shattered with sort of no sleep, or you're sort of trying to sleep and then you're woken up. It's coming back in for something. So you basically have no sleep for, I'd probably say, a good 48 hours. And then driving back on whatever road it is, back from Snetterton, back to Coventry at the time, in my 2.8 injection Capri, and then just wondering how the hell I got home because I can't remember any of the journey. That was probably it, but it sticks in your mind.
It sticks in.
It's probably the worst car I've had, but it's that journey that you just think that I was probably doing a ridiculous speed in a straight line, and I can't remember going around any corners or anything.
It's amazing how your brain does that. It's like, it just goes, what's important? Like, what's the stuff I don't need to remember? I don't want to use any extra energy.
Yeah.
Like, let's just get there, maybe, hopefully. I look at the like mechanics staying up for 24 hours in a 24-hour race, which seems to happen like quite a lot. And like, as a driver, I would not do that if I could help it, because we know how much our brains like fall off. But like, when something happens 3 hours before the end of the race, it's still, everyone still seems to just have something reserved in them to be able to just switch it on and off you go.
It's the adrenaline, isn't it, that keeps you going? But it's, I think when you get to the end of it, because bearing in mind it's a 24-hour race that you're there, but you're actually there in the morning. The race starts at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, but you're there in the morning to set everything up. So it's, you know, it's probably 30-odd hours that you're awake and in the pit garage. And you do just want to go home.
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah. Yeah.
It's
probably
a 2 hour drive home from there for at the time. But
as a photographer and even as a driver, I've done some 24 hour stuff. I'd love it if they started at like 10 a.m. because you wake up, you do the race, and then you only have to wait till 10 a.m. the next day. It's like 3 p.m. You've had a full day pretty much before it starts. And then you just obviously got another 24 hours.
Yeah, and then somebody's expecting you to pack it all away at the end of
it
as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Load the car up. And
yeah, because you're getting booted out of the garage. You've got to go. If you could only drive one car for the rest of your life, say a sports car, what would it be?
Well, I'd have to say one of my 911s, wouldn't I think? But I think if it's for the rest of my life, I'd be getting a little bit older, so I probably wouldn't be able to get in and out of it so easy. I think it would be any older car. It would be one of our cars. I think it would be like an ST. It would be like the demonstrator car that I've just built and sold. Yeah. I think it would be that one.
Nice.
But I am very biased.
that's fair enough. Yeah, I think you're perfectly entitled. And it is like, this is what you want out of a car. Like, this whole thing is like you, isn't it?
Yeah. So, you know, that car down there is like, okay, I built it all myself. You know, Joe's done a lot of work downstairs for me and sort of put most of it together, or if not all of it together. Yeah, that's exactly the car that I want, that I've built. So it's going to have to be that one. I can't say anything else, can I?
Yeah.
Otherwise, I wouldn't have built it.
I feel like that one from a competitor down the road, you've got a problem.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to do that because I could just take it back with everything that's wrong all the time. So fix that and fix this.
Yeah, get it out of my sight. What do you think is the most undervalued car at the moment?
Of all makes?
Yeah, anything out there.
I think at the moment, undervalued cars are probably old British cars.
Yeah.
Like MGAs and stuff like that. I don't think they're, you know, German and Italian stuff's probably way over what it should be worth. But you look at some of those old MGAs, I think you see them at 20 grand. They should be an awful lot more than that, but they're not. They're quite stylish cars, but it's crap British workmanship. But, you know, they're still quite, I think they're just a bit undervalued. I just don't think it's caught up.
I think that's a good answer. And I think there's a lot of old British cars that are not worth very much that you go, that's still pretty cool. And it was like, it's sort of competitors are now all worth a lot more.
Yeah. I can't sit here and say 911s are undervalued because they're not.
They're quite expensive, aren't they?
And Ferraris aren't undervalued. They never have been. You know, Porsches have just sort of caught up with him over the last 5 years.
Yeah. What is the most interesting car to you at the moment?
The most interesting car to me at the moment?
I imagine it's an EV, isn't it? Yeah.
I think everybody that has an EV car is going to burn in hell.
We talked actually earlier about, and I think this is quite a good story. We were talking about lithium batteries. You've got a story about a lithium battery you put in a car.
Yeah, so we thought we'd evolve with the world and the Greenpeace lot. And we started putting these lightweight lithium batteries into just as the normal battery for starting the car and running it. And that, you know, the theory is good and the technology is good and they are very light. But there's a few instructions that you sort of have to go along with, and it's to do with charging them and jump starting them. So you can't jump start them and you can't put a normal battery charger on it. You've got to use their little phone charger that goes with it. So we put one on, it was one of my demonstrator cars. It was my orange RSR at the time. And it was great. I thought, yeah, that's cool. You know, that's our modern bit of technology. That's our
saved a bit of weight.
Yeah. That's our EV part that we're going to do to it. And that's the end of it. But it went off to a body shop to have, scratch done. I think it was like a small scratch sorted out, and the battery had gone flat. And then they jumped it with a jump pack, which, you know, it's not their fault. Nobody knows any different. And then I went to go and pick the car up and they jumped it again before I got there and the car was running. I thought, oh, that's fair enough. And then sort of probably 4 miles down the road, the smell started getting worse. The car was running fine, but the smell was getting worse and worse. And I thought, it's just paint fumes from the body shop, the good old two-pack paint coming through from the old days. Good for your lungs. And then all of a sudden I was just like blasted with a smoke bomb coming in through the car, thick white smoke, couldn't breathe, couldn't open my eyes. I only just managed to find the door handle and sort of jump out of the car. And the battery had caught fire. And it started melting and sort of, it was properly on fire, but because I was sat in the time in my £250,000 car thinking, I don't want this going up. We've only just finished it. I managed to get the bonnet open and sort of with a stick at the side of the road, sort of yank the wires off and pull it out because the battery had turned to sort of jelly. The battery was still burning 3 days later, you know, and that's just
You obviously didn't put the battery back in the car.
No, so I called Joe. I said, Joe, get over here quick. Bring a fire extinguisher. Bearing in mind it was like 20 minutes away, you know, it would have gone up good and proper. So I took the battery out and I put it to the sort of side of the road.
This on fire, molten battery.
On fire with a thick white smoke coming out of it. You know, it looked like a monstrous bonfire on bonfire night. Jeez. Just coming out of this small car battery. It was horrendous. And then it just kept burning. And by the time we got there in the van, it was just still burning. So we put it out with a fire extinguisher. I thought, that's okay. I'm going to take this back in the van. So he bought a spare battery and we put another battery in the car. So luckily, we didn't do any damage to the car.
That is quite lucky.
Yeah, it was just because the battery sort of turned into a blob of plastic and managed to rip it out without undoing it. So we'll take it back and we'll sort of send it back to the battery manufacturers and just sort of have it a whinge and a moan about it. So we put it out with the fire extinguisher. By the time we got back here again, it had self-ignited again.
In the back of the van?
Yeah. So we put it down the side and around the back of the building and left it there. I thought, well, it's going to go out. It was still smoking 3 days later. Yeah, and it that sort of brings home the danger of it.
Yeah. Because I think loads of new cars come with lightweight, not loads, but some come with lightweight lithium-ion batteries as non-EVs, but sports cars. And I don't feel like anyone really tells you specifically, like, look me in the eyes. Do not jump this with a normal set of jump cables, or like, do not plug in a normal battery charger. Luckily, like, lots of the new ones are sort of intelligent, and they know if it's a lithium one, and they won't junk it. But yeah, setting a lithium ion battery on fire, that's not a good situation.
That was probably one of the scariest things that happened to me. That was,
I can imagine, like, horrific.
Yeah. You know, it was just, so we don't fit those anymore.
Fair enough.
We're back onto the old lead batteries again. Safe.
They're quite a lot lighter, aren't they? They're like 5 kilos or something.
It was loads lighter. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, interesting one. Right, final question. We have talked briefly about this, but 5-car garage, unlimited value. Go.
5-car garage, unlimited value would be... Escort Cosworth for 600 horsepower.
Nice.
One of my Ren Sport cars.
Yeah.
Audi Quattro, short wheelbase. You are Quattro, one of those.
Yeah.
I really like the 991 GT3 RS. Nice. Whether I'd actually use it or not, but I'd like to look at it.
Yeah.
One more would... You lost me there.
You can have it.
Anything I want.
Some classic, some race car, some...
It would be
hypercar. A daily driver. Do you have a daily driver?
No, I don't want a daily driver. No, I'll have a bus passport. It would be a Mark 1 Escort RS 1600.
Nice.
You know, the twin cam ones.
So I can sense a theme.
They're just all nice cars to look at.
Yeah.
No, I don't. And out of all of those, I think the GT3 RS would probably just never get used.
Right. Well, there we go. Thanks very much for coming on the podcast.
It's fine. Good to meet you.
Yeah. Cheers.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.